Today, payments and banking in Australia. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australia flavour. And today I'm joined by Nikesh, who's the author of a really very large and very important book on payments and banking in Australia. Hi, Nikesh.
That's right, Martin. And good news, it's a number one bestseller on Amazon. It's great to be here. And Martin, I really do like your programs, and it's fantastic to be able to share this with your listeners.
Well, it's great to have you on, and congratulations on your number one spot there on Amazon. I mean, this is a really, really critically important subject. And of course, what's interesting about the book there is you don't just talk about the current situation, but you go back over history, because actually by looking at history, you can then understand more about where we are currently.
That's right. That's exactly it. So look, it is set in an Australian context. We do go back, though, a lot further, right? So obviously before European settlement, Indigenous Australians had a very rich culture, and they did a lot of trade. We cover that. We look back even further at world history of money, of payments, of exchange largely. And then really pick it up with the arrival of the first fleet and Australia's involvement. So look, it covers a lot of the history right from the beginning, all the way to, what's happening today.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting, of course, because even before the Westerners landed here, right, there was actually commerce and trade going on in Australia, wasn't there?
Yeah, that's right. So the Aboriginal Australians particularly talk about song lines. So there's... they're basically trade routes where they would exchange goods, ochre, all sorts of things from one end of the country to the other. It was amazing. There's archaeological evidence for that widespread trade. More recent than that, we're talking a few thousand years ago, there's evidence of trade with India. There's evidence of trade, with Indians. There's evidence of trade with Malaysians and particularly in the Northern Territory. There's quite a rich history there.
Yeah, and sometimes people think that somehow money started, with the Bank of England and stuff. But there's another side to this. But obviously, once the English landed and other people landed from other Western economies, that then changed the shape of Australia and presumably changed the shape of commerce.
Well, yeah, that's true. Well, interestingly enough, there was a money problem in England when Australia was settled. There weren't enough coins. The earliest coins that we had were actually Spanish dollars. There was a big shortage of coins all over. And some of our early governors did some amazing things to try and encourage the use or the retention of coins in the colony. However, there wasn't enough to go around. And the nearest British settlement was... in Calcutta in India, and we would get a lot of goods from there to supply a store here. And store receipts were used as the earliest currency. Eventually, rum became the oddly enough, the currency of trade, as many of your listeners would know.
And that's quite fascinating, right? So rather than depositing the banks, you count the number of bottles you have.
Exactly. Yeah, and a number of governors looked at that, quite rightly, and said, "Look, this is a problem." And I think Governor Bligh attempted to ban it, which resulted in Australia's first and only coup, the Rebellion.
Exactly. Yeah, it can only happen in Australia. And of course, as things developed, the monetary system developed too. And presumably it sort of settled down through the 19th and into the earlier 20th century. But when Australia became more its own center of gravity, how did that change the payment systems?
Yeah, so initially, the earliest bank in the early 1800s was the Bank of New South Wales, now Westpac, quite popular news at the moment. But they were our first bank. They issued we started issuing promissory notes or bank notes and that really changed the game quite a bit. And then gradually, cash and checks became the norm for payments. We began issuing our own coins. Oddly enough, the gold rush allowed us to develop our own currency, our own coins. Adelaide, and this is quite interesting, was the first government to issue a locally made coin, right, as a result of the gold rush. So they issued gold bullion that was minted there, very fine quality. And I think those coins, soon after that, Sydney issued them, and the value of those coins hasn't changed. It's still the gold value, the sovereigns. But the sovereigns that were issued in Adelaide are worth millions of dollars today. So, quite an interesting development. And then gradually over time, obviously that improved. And, you know, we ended up with, you know, a number of modernizations. And Australia was involved in a lot of the changes that resulted in the international development of currency, of money, and in the early days of the plastic cards as well.
Right. So before we went decimal, right, I assume it was the pound, right, and mirroring the UK. So when did that really become the main medium of exchange in Australia?
Yeah, so look, it was a medium of exchange early on. And the problem, as we mentioned, was that there weren't enough coins to go around. So the governors did an interesting thing. In order to retain the coins here, they increased the value of British coins by a penny or a shilling. So if you kept it here, your money was worth more. If you took the coins overseas, it was worth less, obviously. So that helped retain the currency. And in 1800, they issued the governor at the time, King, issued a proclamation that put a value on every coin that was in the colony, and most of these were foreign coins. And you know, we see a lot of these signs on George Street now, right, in foreign exchange dealerships, where they've got currency exchange rates for every conceivable currency you can think of. We had these since 1800. you know, with different coins having different values.
That's fascinating. I didn't realize that it went back so far. If you think about it, it's obvious, isn't it, with all of the different visitors coming and going, and all with their own currencies. Now, of course, So then we had you know, the First World War and then the Second World War. To what extent did those international conflicts then change the way that payments evolved?
Yeah, so look, that was quite important, because I think and Australia really had a big role to play in that history, which is I don't think many people know. So, World War One resulted in the reparations for Germany, and that was opposed by a gentleman called John Keynes, who's considered to be the father of modern macroeconomics. No one listened to him at the time. Likewise with the Depression, he took the view that, you know, let the printers run, let's issue more money. We ignored him then. We ignored him at the end of World War One, and I think a lot of people would suggest that economic policy led to World War Two, and that was obviously a disaster. By the end of World War Two, everyone was listening to Keynes. Okay, he'd already predicted the Great Depression. We didn't listen to him then. He warned us against what was happening at the end of World War One with Germany. Everyone was listening to him, and I think it was D-Day. 1 month after D-Day, it was apparent to the Allies that the war would be won. It was still another year to go before World War Two ended. However, that was an important turning point in the history of money. So a United Nations conference was formed in Bretton Woods to discuss monetary policy. And out of that came a number of things. So, sadly, as respected as John Keynes was, and I think this was in his final years of his life, he was defeated in principle by the Americans, who were now the new superpowers. So he came up with a few fascinating ideas, and we can talk about them later. I think we're seeing it with stablecoin today, like the Bancor, which was a basket of currencies, a coin, if you like, that was the international medium of exchange. That was his suggestion. And in discussions with all of the allies, I think there were 160 nations there, and Australia was one of them. Everyone, ended up accepting the US position, which was to use the US dollar as the international currency. We had the formation of the IMF and the World Bank, et cetera. One country stood with John Keynes, only one. And to the extent where John himself was willing to compromise, and that country was Australia.
Hmm.
And Australia withheld signing this the final papers of this conference. It was the only country that did. Even Russia signed them. Australia was the only one that withheld. And our principle was that in monetary policy, we wanted to maintain full employment. And that was a really big stand. And to this day, if you go to the Reserve Bank, you can see that one of our objectives in monetary policy is the maintenance of full employment. And that's something that we gave to the world.
That's pretty remarkable, isn't it, when you think about it? Now, of course, then we've got the evolution of technology. We've got the proliferation of different payment channels, from cards and checks and all those sorts of things. To what extent did Australia lead that, or were we just reacting to developments that were happening elsewhere?
Yeah, so absolutely. I think we were connected with the rest of the world because it was important that we were importing and exporting. Obviously, it was important that we could, get value for our goods and services. So, and that started with wool as a pseudo commodity. Australia wrote off the sheep's back, as they say. It moved into other goods and services. What you found over time was that new payment methods started to evolve. And one of the things that we developed early on was a telegraph system. We could develop that better than any other country because the landline links to Europe were overland, and there were problems with connecting submarine cables. So we only needed a short one from the Northern Territory to Indonesia. And that enabled us to wire transfer in the early days. And, that trend continued. And in fact, we were the first when we developed cards because of the size of the country, we were the first to develop an international standard for cards. It's called AS2805. It's an Australian standard. And that was 2 years before the international standard, which is now the way that everyone pays. Whenever you use your credit card, use a standard called ISO 8583. It's based on a standard that was implemented 2 years earlier in Australia, and this is a global thing. We were also the first country to do an intercontinental payment transfer through a company in Australia that was later taken over by First Data, now Fiserv. So we had a really big part to play in all these payment mechanisms.
Mm. And of course, the rise of mobile phones and digital technologies through that way, we've tended to be early adopters there too.
Yeah, exactly. So Australians have taken to that very quickly. We were the first bank through a bank that I previously worked at to develop an iPhone mobile NFC payment capability. We took to that very early. We more recently and you may see this in Australia, Hub Terminal an Android terminal that can accept payments through touchscreen. That was the first in the world, and now that's spawned a lot of terminals that will be increasingly popular.
Absolutely. And now, of course, we're coming now through to that digital revolution, right, which effectively starts to now create some very interesting tussles between the traditional payment mechanisms, which is pretty much controlled by, you know, a series of very large organizations under central bank control, more or less. And we've now got the proliferation of digital alternatives, Bitcoin and those sorts of things. And there's a real tussle going on at the moment between old world, new world. How do you read that?
Yeah, so look, I think what we're seeing is something quite amazing, right? So, you know, originally we started off with, and in the book I cover this, that we started off with, you know, precious metals that were commodities. So coins, gold, and so on. And they had a value in themselves. And then we moved into, you know, paper money, which was backed by gold. That then transformed into what we now call fiat currencies. So paper money that was no longer backed by gold. And that started in Australia around the Great Depression, right? So there was a run on the banks around then. And at that point, they reduced the amount of gold you could get. And gradually, that's been reduced and reduced. And we're finding now that the paper money is just paper money. And after COVID, we're seeing that we're no longer using notes and coins as much as we were before, right? There's a lot of hoarding going on. That's a different story. But we're no longer using notes and coins as we were before. We're using electronic means of exchange. And then with that, we saw the rise of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, which was phenomenal. And what that's doing is it's loosening our connection with the old forms of money. But I think what I'm finding is that, and the reason I wrote this book is so much of our behavior is driven by our habits. And even as we develop these new forms of currency, we're still sticking to our old habits. Like everyone now wants a Bitcoin. When I think Satoshi didn't intend it to be something that you could hoard. It was more, look, this is a better way to, you know, move money around.
Yes, and it's very interesting, of course, because now central banks, for example, are now fretting about the rise of the, you know, alternatives, and should there be a central bank digital currency? Should there be a stable coin? Should there be, you know, more control? Because, of course, they're concerned about losing control of money supply and even things like AML and those sorts of things. And I don't know whether I'm pretty sure you did. There was a bulletin from the Reserve Bank a couple of weeks ago talking about what Reserve Bank is thinking about with regard to central bank digital currencies. But there seems to me to be a really big tussle going on between, if you like, old world, new world, centralized versus decentralized, you know, blockchain versus not. There are so many moving parts of this, and it's moving very quickly now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So look. I think there's so much to unpack in that whole cryptocurrency blockchain world. So I think this particular thing that you raised around stablecoins is quite interesting. So, you know, what we've seen there is we had cryptocurrency. Right. And cryptocurrency, as everyone's figured out, is very volatile. Right. So the value of a Bitcoin was 6 cents. In no time, it went up to, you know, almost no time. It went up to $1,000. It dropped back down to 20 cents again. And then it rose up, I think, to 20, you know, nearly was it $20,000 Australian a couple of years ago. And it's come back down and it's going back up. It's very volatile. Right, so the idea that you know, some espouse was this stable coin, right? So a stable unit of currency, and really, if you unpack money, there, you know, there are three aspects to it. There's the value, there's the ability to store it. So it's a measurement, number one. It's something that you can store, so you can keep $100 in your pocket, and you can use it tomorrow. You can't keep 100 apples and use it next month. And the third thing is it's a medium of exchange. And we're playing around with these things, even though we don't know it. And stablecoin is, I think, an attempt to move us more to a more flexible view of money. But really, what we're finding is our old habits are dying hard. And, you know, if I can say this, originally stablecoin, the idea was that yes, cryptocurrencies are volatile, but so are normal currencies. The stablecoin that Facebook originally proposed was a basket of currencies. So over that basket, you'd expect some stability. So you've got the yen there, you've got the US dollar there, you've got the British pound, you've got the euro and the Australian dollar. Now, a basket of those currencies shouldn't fluctuate so much. That was the thinking of stablecoin. And now I think, you know, what the US have come out with is stablecoins are okay as long as they're linked to one currency at the moment. And that's where the old habits are dying hard. Obviously, and then if you think about it, you know, how is that really different to a stored value card? But what it is doing is it's flexing our muscles and making us think about money in different terms, which I think is fascinating. And that journey is going to continue. And what we end up with may be nothing like the money that we use today.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of really interesting observations, right? The fact that the US has come out and said, yeah, stable coin's okay, but it's going to be linked to guess which currency, right?
Exactly.
Basically, in a way, completely degrades the concept of what they were perhaps trying to achieve in the first place. I mean, those who wanted to get away from centralized control. And it goes back to what I was talking about earlier on, about the tussle between centralized, devolved, you know, central banks wanting to be able to control the flow of money and those sorts of things, right? Which is, as you say, the old habits die hard, right? And a lot of the discussion at the moment, and I've been following this quite closely amongst central bankers, is, there's clearly going to be a place for a digital alternative, but nevertheless, it's going to have a lot of characteristics of the old world, right? So, and then you've got other people who are saying, no. There's a whole new world out there of you know, frankly, deregulated, not controlled at all. You know, whether it's tokenized or whether it's on a ledger somewhere, a completely different way of dealing with, you know, transference of value and those sorts of things. And I'm seeing these massive tussles going on between old world, new world, and to what extent both the regulators and governments and also individuals are willing and want to adopt. And I think that's why the future is quite clearly going to be different from where we come from. But the question is, who's going to win? You know, are we going to see central banks and governments exerting effectively massive control, so effectively we have a digital version of what we've got today with all of the features and benefits? And we'll talk about some of those in a second, right? And particularly the risks, and we'll talk about regulation because that's an important thing. Or is it going to be evolving to something different? And I think that tussle is probably the most fascinating thing to explore at the moment, because it is genuinely uncertain about how this is going to play out.
That's right. And I think a lot of people make, and you know, Satoshi was amazing. But in his paper, he was inspired, around 2007, at the notion that the U.S. government could print a lot of money, right, and devalue your, they had quantitative easing back then, but it could devalue the value of your assets. What a lot of people don't realize is that the amount of money that is actually issued by government, and now it's not just printed, it's issued electronically, is only a small fraction of the money that's out there. A big chunk of that money is private bank money, right? It's your credit card, it's your loans, it's essentially the principle that, if you deposit money, the bank lends it out again, and then that multiplies, and that creates 80% of the money that's in the economy. Now that the rules that guide that are even flimsier than the ones that central banks use. So that's the fascinating thing. And I think what we're sitting on is a time bomb. And if that there's no science behind, you know, why we've got the amount of money that we've got in the economy, but if that blows up and we find that our money is no longer the stable thing we thought it was, that could be quite disruptive.
Mm. Well, it's very interesting you say that, because, of course, there is the slightly alternative view of the way that money works, which is that loans come first, and that basically can be magic into existence, let it become. That then flows into it, create deposits. And, in fact, it's the ability of the banks to continue to lend and grow their book, which actually can increase the value, the volume of money, and there is no end to that, right? Until you end up with people not being able to borrow more. And of course, today we heard the announcement in Australia that they're actually dialing back consumer protection for responsible lending and putting more acid back on consumers rather than the banks. So, guess where that's going to lead?
That's right. And that tussle's been going on, right? So we saw that, look, in 1974, Australia came up with the bank card, which revolutionized. Like, this has been happening to us very gradually, but it, it, If you go back, you know, to the, you know, what I cover in the beginning of the book, it, you know, we really didn't, money wasn't that big a deal. It wasn't that important, as important part of, you know, our livelihoods as it is now. And what we found in 74 was that the birth of consumerism, right? And then credit was issued to everyone. So you didn't even have to apply. You would get a credit card. If you had five accounts, you'd get five credit cards, $300 each, which was a lot of money back then. And now what we're finding is, okay, the regulators have come in and the responsible lending is there. We can't even give you an increase unless you ask for one. And credit cards largely are dying, which is phenomenal. I think we would have had, most cards would have been credit cards about a decade ago. Now we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing a lot of debit cards.
Yeah.
And then what's even more phenomenal with that is the rise of buy now, pay later, which is an unregulated, I can't say unregulated, it's regulated, but it's a less regulated form of credit.
It's not seen as credit, is it? It's just sort of shifting payments, right? Interesting,
that's right.
Interesting debate there, which the regulators I think are looking at the moment. But given the COVID crisis, of course, everybody is going to be encouraged to spend more. So it'll be, I suspect, continue to run the way it's running at the moment, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Look, that's been the problem, right? So there's been this tightening. We had COVID, and now they need that loosening.
Yeah.
And then that, you know, like if we recover out of this COVID, then there'll be a glutton of credit, right? Yeah. And then we'll end up in this situation where we could end up, you know, who knows, where money is no longer the stable thing we once thought it was.
Yeah. Right.
And that's going to lead to the massive change that you're talking about.
Yeah, right. And you know, I often talk about the debt bomb getting bigger and bigger, and it's going going off at some point. But the other point I just wanted to touch on before we close is this issue of regulation, right? Because there have been a whole bunch of cases where, you know, banks have been doing the wrong thing, the Royal Commission, the AML, the Westpac fine this week highlights the fact that there's also a regulatory lens through this, has to be looked through as well. And I wonder what your view is of that.
Yeah, look, I think for a lot of people that were in the industry, you know, what happened was extremely disappointing. And I think, at a number of fronts. So if you look at these fines, and if you use the loose definition of crime being, breaking the law, which is what most people understand it to be, these two crimes, the CBA failure and the Westpac failure, are the largest dollar value crimes in Australia's history, right? Everyone loves a good murder mystery. Azaria Chamberlain grabbed attention for ages. But look, if you really want to look at the big crimes, these two are the, you know, major ones. And it's been a pity that I think that we haven't had an open investigation of them, either in a court of law or, you know, through shareholders and through the organisations themselves. And, I think the failing is that it's extraordinarily difficult to understand, which is one of the reasons that I wrote the book for lay people, because the technology's moved so far ahead. But underlying it, if you do understand it, it is actually quite simple. Once you look into the root causes, all the regulators are trying to do is stop the unidentified movement of money, really, at its heart. And I think that failing is terrible. And quite honestly, I think the culture of the organisations that brought about this failing needs to be looked at, because a lot of the people that were part of the failures are still running these organisations.
Yep. Well, you know, there's a broader cultural issue, of course, because the Royal Commission more broadly highlighted some of the cultural norms that were there in terms of lending behaviour and other things. And that seems a lot like a long time ago. And I wonder how much has really changed. But, that's probably another story. Now, before we finish, then, the last question I have for you is, you've looked at history, you've come up to today. Put your thoughts forward. How do you think payments will be, in 10 or 15 or 20 years down the track? What are the key characteristics that you'd expect to see in play?
Yeah, look, I think the, where I see money going is, the store, we talked about the three properties, right? The value, the unit of measurement, the value of the exchange of value, and also the store value. I think of the three, two of them are problematic, and we've moved beyond that, right? So the store value, okay, we it's not worth anything having a $100 note. It's just a piece of paper. I think a lot of people get that. The ability for the internet, what we call the internet now, and I term this sort of a shared field of human experience. That's what it is. It's us connecting at a level that we couldn't before. So I cover in the early parts of the book the village, right? So you had small units that where we all knew each other. Now in this global village where we've got this thing called the internet and we're able to exchange things at a level that we couldn't before, we don't need to use a coin to exchange value. There's so much more that you can do. And I think that evolution is going to be huge, right? Discovering that, look, you don't need something in the middle to be able to exchange. So you walk in with your ledger to a shop and you just do an IOU, and we know you because you're digitally identified. We know you because your ledger's good. You've honored every debt that you've ever had. Do we actually need to do a payment right now? Probably not. And I think that's going to be, one big change. The other one, I think is just the, we've got these big institutions, banks and so on, that have been, if you like, the bottleneck in the system. And that's who we rely on for our money and so on. I think that's going to go through a massive change. Right. And I think that, in the book I cover a lot of potential disruptions, but I think these are the two big ones, right? So the potential death of these institutions and the movement of money and payments into something that's very different to what we experience today.
Right. So basically what you're saying is that the technology will break down a lot of those barriers, break down a lot of the disintermediate a lot of the parties that are actually currently in the payments chain, and perhaps make an immediate atomization of value exchange one to the other. I guess that takes you into a future where you might end up not with multiple currencies, but, a single unified approach where effectively value can be moved around much more quickly, much more effectively, without all of the intermediaries.
Exactly. And I think the big inhibitor is not really the technology. It's our behavior. And, we talk about Pavlov's dogs and so on, but we've been accustomed over, I won't say centuries, it hasn't really been that long. We've been accustomed over decades to behave a certain way. And, and like you were saying with cryptocurrencies, so the first reaction of people is, oh, I want one of those in my pocket. And I think what we're going to see is just our change in behavior, and technology will make that possible. But really it's our behavior that's going to change, and that's going to be the biggest thing.
Right. And last point for me on that. And if you look at the intergenerational movements there and how younger people are just so much more comfortable with the technology and digital now, it's just the way things are. Right. So there is going to be a natural evolution as people age and as younger people come through what I call digital natives, which will also be the other driving force for those things. So in a way, you may have the old world of central bank, and central bank is trying to worry about things over here, but the revolution of digital, which I think is huge, and people don't fully understand yet where it could end up, and neither do I, but it's coming, and it's coming very fast, I think is inevitable.
We thought the internet was dead with the dot-com bomb back then, and I 100% agree with you. This is bigger than anything, and it's not the internet anymore. It's going to be bigger than that.
Yep.
And you're spot on. I think the term paradigm shift was coined in the area of quantum physics, and they basically said, look, the old physicists have to die off, literally die off, before we can really understand what this new virtual probabilistic world looks like. And I think it's the same thing with money. It's the same thing with payments, that the digital age is going to bring about around a generation that will be able to imagine things in ways that we couldn't do.
Yep, exactly. Well, fascinating talking with you, Nikesh. Thank you very much for that. Now, if people want to get more information about your book and about you, where do they go?
Yeah, so just Google Payments and Banking in Australia, the book. or link me in. You know, I'm quite accessible. A lot of the information is there. You can get a sample, buy it online, etc.
And pay digitally. Nikesh, thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it. And I might leave the door open, if I may, to come back and have a further conversation with you in more detail, because I'd like to go down the next level and perhaps explore some of the other issues in the book in more detail. But I really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, Martin. I appreciate it. Thank you. It's been great being here.
Cheers. Thank you.